I don't know how fucking rivers work, Joanna. Everything's underwater. There is a major weather event in Suffolk, England, which is where we live.
Yeah, it's all a bit floody.
Everything, which is thematic.
Yes.
It's on theme. So I said that so enthusiastically. Lots of people have had their cars washed away today. But
I like how you're trying to be more serious about it and just laughing more.
Because I'm a self-absorbed prick and I really like a line I wrote the other day in like a fucking health and safety thing about not driving into floodwater, which was timely. But I was like, you know, each year we see footage of cars pirouetting gently down the road.
Oh, I love that.
And that has happened today. My office is, by the looks of it, certainly the road it's on has been flooded. So luckily I was working from home today.
Otherwise, you would have been kayaking home in time for the podcast.
Well, yeah, exactly. Just judging by the fact I saw a photo of the road in that state.
Yeah.
Whereas my tiny little Toyota would probably have had to have been rowed home down the A14.
Bobbing along. No, that's down in the sea.
On the bottom of the...
Row, row, row your boat. That's what I was thinking of.
On the bottom of the newly flooded A14.
There we go. It scans. Did you see... I saw a video of somewhere on the coast of Scotland, that's because the northeast has been really hit as well. Where the winds have whipped up the sea so bad that there's like giant amounts of sea foam.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it looks like a giant
globe.
It looks like a giant foam party.
Oh wow, yeah.
Like someone's had a really enthusiastic bubble bath. Again, should not laugh. Horrible situation for many people.
I went for a 20-yard walk to the river to make sure it wasn't about to burst its banks, and it was nowhere near, so I was like, okay, wandered back indoors.
I'm glad your house isn't now part of the river.
Yes, well, we live in a bit where that's not impossible.
Think about it, though. If the river floods and starts joining up with the back of your property, then the property value goes up because you've got a lovely riverside cottage.
But then the rent goes up.
I don't own the
fucking property.
Oh, yeah.
How's your baking?
I'm not looking forward to attempting this week's recipe. That's happening tomorrow.
What is it?
Miniature caramelized white chocolate cheesecakes with a blackcurrant gel on top.
Oof.
However, I don't have the silicone molds to make the miniature version, so I'm making two sort of bigger but small cheesecakes rather than six mini cheesecakes.
Yep, that makes sense.
I did actually try and buy one because I think the timing was really unfair for this challenge, so I wanted to do it as close as possible to replicate it, but I didn't check the size, so when it turned up, it's a bit too small.
How often do you buy things and not check the size?
So often.
Yeah, me too. Seems like a lesson you'd learn but it's not, is it?
The problem is that I think in my head I know what 5 centimetres is, but because I work in a mixture of centimetres and inches quite a lot, I quite often mix up 5 centimetres versus 5 inches and end up with tiny silicone molds that I'm going to try a miniature brownie situation in. Francine, get your mind out of the gutter.
Absolutely not. It's flooded. It's clean in there. It's fine.
Nothing flooded in this town is clean.
No, that's true. Nothing flooded anywhere is clean, listeners. As always, don't take my travel advice.
Do not throw a Toyota down the A14.
No matter how well the lyrics scan. I don't really like cheesecake, but you've made cheesecakes I've really enjoyed in the past.
The thing is, I'm really fucking good at cheesecake, but this is quite literally not my mother's cheesecake, which is annoying because I can do my mother's cheesecake recipe with my eyes closed, my hands tied behind my back. Don't ask how.
Okay.
But also the caramelized white chocolate thing, like on the show, they had to do it in the microwave. Obviously, I am not purchasing a microwave for the process.
So it's in a microwave. Yeah.
My kitchen's too small for a microwave. So yeah, I'll be MacGyvering that somehow. It's all going to go tits up. Oh, and I can get blackcurrant, so I'm making a blueberry gel instead.
Mm. Iceland do for it, but it's always mixed up with something else. Yeah,
I couldn't find blackcurrant, and I don't want to use frozen because that's going to fuck with my timing.
Oh, right, yeah, that's always frozen.
If I've got to make it and set it and all that bollocks. So yeah, we'll see how this all comes out.
I'm sure it'll be fine. Anything else been going on?
Yeah, I have news. I have big news.
Oh, what's that?
I officially got my yes.
That's right, we're going to get married.
Francine, don't toy with me. No, I pitched a new book to my publisher last week. They have said yes, so I am officially about to start work on my second book.
Can you tell us about it?
Yes, the working title, which probably won't be the final title, is From Sunnydale to Riverdale, Teenagers as Television Tastemakers. So it's a history of 30 years of teen drama on television, different shows, get different chapters. I am going to have to watch so much stuff for this. And it will be out year after next, probably.
Cool. Have we told people when you're...
I don't officially know.
Yeah.
I don't officially know when my first book is coming out, but we're looking at next summer.
Cool.
And we're very excited about that too. So yes, I had the joy for a full 5 seconds when I got the yes from the publisher, followed immediately by the, oh fuck, I've got to write a book again.
Ah, terror. Our only motivation.
Vaguely started working on it by just, I started watching Gilmore Girls again.
Sure.
Which I absolutely don't need to rewatch from the book, as I have realised by putting it on for a nice comfort, because it's a nice comforting autumny binge.
It is.
It's cozy. And yes, I've realised I have every single line, story beat, episode order, most of the episode titles, every interesting guest actor that turns up, pretty fucking memorised, and don't need to watch it again.
Yeah. Also, we're very much in the age group now where it's weird to watch it and be like, oh, I used to have a crush on that guy who was a child.
Yeah, very much so. Luckily, now that I am 30, I absolutely fancy multiple adults in the show. And if I'm being realistic, it always was kind of Luke.
Obviously.
Yeah. He really hates everything. And I'm just...
Yeah, just very much into that vibe.
Yeah. All right, so I'm going to briefly, before we start recording, just do an essay comparing Luke Danes from Gilmore Girls to Sam Vimes.
I have a horrible news for you, Joanna. We have been recording for some time.
Shit. Right, in that case, do you want to make a podcast?
Yes, all right, let's make a podcast. You do the essay during the break.
Hello and welcome to The Truth Shall Make You Fret, a podcast in which we are reading and recapping every book from Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, one at a time, in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And this is part three of our discussion of Thud.
It's thudded.
The thrilling conclusion.
Oh, it's thrilling.
It is actually quite thrilling.
Yeah, it is a pretty good conclusion.
Yeah. Now, on spoilers, before we crack on, we are a spoiler light podcast, obviously heavy spoilers for the book Thud, but we are going to avoid spoiling any major future events in the Discworld series, and we're saving any and all discussion of the final Discworld novel, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there, so you, dear listener, can come on the journey with us.
Powered through miles of freezing water by a malevolent eldritch force within us.
As always, not a recommendation.
Oh, no, that one is.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
But not Kaya King.
You really do need that malevolent force inside you. You can't just jump in.
Right. I don't have anything to follow up on this week. So, Francine, do you want to tell us what happened previously on Thud?
I certainly do. Previously on Thud. Sally and Angua investigate several mine crimes while Vimes quiets riots with apples. Well, mostly apples. Later, Mr. Shine invites Vimes to watch the water of cultural change trickle through his multicultural board game group. But the drums of war are thudding in the distance, and when Sam gets home, he's faced with an all-too-personal personification of the old ways. Vimes' attackers meet grisly fates without his direct intervention, but the commander must fight down his demons, or perhaps one specific demon, when the community leaders pay him a visit the next day.
Ooh. Right.
What happened this time?
A lot.
Yeah. All right, cool. Next.
All right, let's see if I can do this. The girls have gone out, avec tourney. Meanwhile, Vimes sits down with a thud board to interview Helm Clever. As Clever quickly clicks his trolls across the board, he explains Hamcrusher's orders and the deaths in the mine. The dwarfs have left the city with the cube and the painting, and Vimes finally clocks the importance of the art theft. Just as the puzzle becomes a picture, the candles go out and Helm Clever goes down untouched. Bashfulson promises to vouch for Vimes, provided he can come to Coombe Valley. I know it's not provided that he can, but the alliteration opportunity was there.
There was some internal rhyming. I appreciated it.
Yeah, thank you. While the girls have fun, with a capital F, Sir Reynold gets caught up on the Coombe Valley case and Sybil reveals that she made a copy up in the attic. After a bar catches fire and a thoughtful Tawny heads home, Visit finds a sick Sally with the rest and stands them back up. The copy of the painting reveals the clue in the skyline and Vimes wants to go to the valley. Sybil's coming along, of course, as is young Sam. Vimes visits Vetinari, who's taking care of the politics, and he doesn't go and speak to Ridcully in a shed. In the morning, the coaches are raring to go and our ragtag bunch of multi-species misfits set off for Coombe Valley. Things speed up as they get out of the city, and as cruciferous vegetables go catastrophic, there's time for a late breakfast in Quirm. A one last sedate trot into town and they've made it to the Bunties in time for dinner. That night, Angwit hears Sally sneaking. The next day and into the valley, Vime surrounds himself with art and looks at the mountains, eventually finding the original painting and the spot that X doesn't mark. Something tells him to pursue down the dark tunnel and encourages him to let go of the rope. After an unconscious adventure, Vimes is underground and out of the water. He walks on in darkness and death walks with him. It's 6 minutes to 6 and Sybil's getting worried. Vimes follows the Verns and hears his son cry. He finds the dwarfs and his cow and fights through the grags with bat-like assistance. He raises an axe, but the bars fall on the summoning dark and Angwit takes him down. It's all gone political as the Low King arrives. The stalagmites that shocked the grags and safe now, and thankfully, Nobby's acquired the cube. Together, they listen to Brian Bloodaxe, the old Troll King, and hear the history of the Forgotten Treaty. Bashfulson stops Ardent from ending the truth, and the trolls arrive to parley. It's not peace, but at least there are negotiations. As the loose ends are tied up, spies revealed, and trials planned, Sam finally sits for his portrait. Kings wait at the end for Vimes, who, at 6 o'clock, reads to young Sam.
Aw, nice.
He does. It delights me. So, helicopters and loincloths. Plentiful. For loincloth, I'm going with Angua's unexpected magenta feather boa.
Why are we starting with loincloth? You can't do this to me, fucking 129 episodes in.
Fuck, right, sorry. For helicopters, we've got the broomsticks attached to the underside of the coach. And for loincloth, we have Angua's unexpected magenta feather boa.
Perfect.
And as always, which death is here.
Death is here.
Death is here. Isn't that lovely? Yay! Discworld books, the only books where you can genuinely be quite pleased by it.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, have you got a bit about death later?
I will talk about death.
Okay, cool. Yeah, nice.
Quotes. Mine's a bit lengthy, so do you want to go first?
Yeah, absolutely. Mine's very short. You might as well try to make sense of raindrops.
Oh, I love that line.
Talking about Rascal's many eccentric, largely unordered notes of madness. But that's one of the lines that stuck with me in and out of context over the years.
I really like that line because, like, I've not thought of raindrops as particularly nonsensical before, but
yeah, but now, actually, looking out the window, like, what?
Fuck it.
What are you doing?
This is not orderly.
Absolutely ridiculous. And there's just no point in yelling at them.
No. Might as well try and make sense of them.
Right, I'll settle in for yours then.
Put your feet up, get comfy. This is Lady Sybil after Sir Reynold says that it might be too dangerous for her to go to Coombe Valley. Sir Reynold, she said, with a side order of ice. In the year of the lice, my great-grandmother once cooked, personally, a full dinner for 18 in a military redoubt that was entirely surrounded by bloodthirsty Clatchians, and she felt able to include sorbet and nuts. My grandmother, in the year of the quiet monkey, defended our embassy in Pseudopolis against a mob with no assistance but that offered by a gardener, a trained parrot, and a pan of hot chip fat. My late aunt, when our coach was once held up at Bow Point by two desperate highwaymen, gave them such a talking to that they actually ran away crying for their mothers, Sir Reynold, their mothers. We are no strangers to danger, Sir Reynold. May I also remind you that quite probably half the dwarfs who fought at Coombe Valley were ladies. No one told them to stay at home.
Yeah.
God, I love that bit. I love Sybil. Have I mentioned that ever on the podcast that I quite like Sybil Ramkin vibes?
Not that I called me.
Yeah,
that's a good point from Sybil, actually. Read the dwarves and the gender roles. I'm not sure if we've talked about that specifically, in that obviously dwarves in Ankh-Morpork, they're some of the gender roles become a problem because they're not allowed to express themselves in a feminine way. But obviously, in many ways, it's been beneficial because they are allowed to do the traditionally masculine. I mean, it's not beneficial, obviously, to go on a battlefield.
No.
It was also pointed out that the historical recreation, like women were only allowed to do wenching, which is what made me think about it.
I think Cheery explains it quite well in think it's Feet of Clay, when she's sort of coming out to Angra and she says, yes, we can do everything the men can do, provided that we do everything the men can do.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
which I think is quite succinct. Like, yes, okay, no one's saying, oh, you're too weak to be on a battlefield. However, it doesn't mean have to be on a fucking battlefield.
Yeah. Marvellous.
I'm a feminist and not a woman, but if someone was trying to assume that because of that I should be going on a battlefield, I will quite happily embrace every ounce of femininity I've got lying around.
Good old pacifism, that's the way for me.
Yep, pacifism and petticoats.
Pacifism and so little upper body strength that nobody's ever going to ask me to hold a battle axe.
Yeah, this is the thing, I'm weirdly strong.
You've got the biceps, man.
My fitness is atrocious, though.
Like, but you could swing it at least once, and sometimes that's all you need.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine, but if you ask me to do a light jog, like, now we're fucked. Right, let's talk about characters.
Yes.
Should we start with Vimes?
Vimes with his little hanger-on.
With his little summoning dark friend. A couple of moments before we go into the summoning dark specifically, I really like how they stage... I mean, I don't like that Helmklever dies, obviously, but I think it's really interesting how it's staged and Vimes' reaction and putting his hands up, and he says, I can't touch him, please.
Yes, absolutely.
Because it's so reminiscent... We saw him do this in Nightwatch in such a... In a you know, I'm not going to touch him, but in a completely different way. In Nightwatch, he was so in control of that situation.
Yes.
He made sure he had his hands full. He knew how it was going to look.
He whereas, set the scene.
Yes.
Yeah. Whereas this one, he was like, oh, fuck. This was not the plan, even a little bit.
Yeah. And also, just the fucking metaphors when he's in pain there. His ribs were carrying the melody, but knees, elbows and head all added trills and arpeggios.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's just... He's... What's the word? His way of kind of logicking his way through the incredibly illogical, and like his inner monologue is always this like kind of weirdly rational on top of just the utter nonsense that's happening. Always his absolutely delights me.
Complete abject rejection of mysticism. This is someone who lives on the disc, a world that is powered by magic. We don't do mystic. This is just mystic stuff.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with me.
Yeah. And that doesn't make any sense. That's the thing. His rationalism doesn't make sense. Because Vetinari, when he's talking to him, is like, in a very matter-of-fact way, in the same way you might say, oh, somebody, you know, put a dirty bomb on the tube or something. He's like, and it sounds like a dwarf cursed the mine, obviously, when he died. And Vimes is like, oh, I don't believe in that. And Vetinari's like, okay, well, it happened, though, so can we deal with that?
Yeah. Can we acknowledge that curses are because we're on the disc and therefore...
Can I bring you back to unreality, please? Thank you. oh, I wish Vimes and Runeswind had more time together.
Just bloody minded.
Like it, but it would be funny. Yeah.
Bloody minded skepticism in the face of all evidence.
Yeah. Humorous metaphor of this, of course, was Sam Vimes getting off of the carriage, sitting next to a milestone and hugging it until he felt better. I feel like it's very...
Well, yeah, this is the thing. He is so determined to reject the summoning dark as well. It's not something I believe in and it's just mystic and I'm having nothing to do with it. Anyway, the wizards. This coach is going.
Listen, can you do the mysticism bit while I just close my eyes?
There's some genuinely just really great lines about the summoning dark stuff. When Helmklever sends it, comes in darkness and in vengeance and disguise.
The bit where he's, when he was saying like he's talking about his pain, he's like stumbling along and the darkness curled its tail around him. Another beautiful bit. And you know, just the kind of the cleverness of the summoning dark driving a lot of the not behaviors but the events without making it obvious. So when Sam Vimes slams his hand down on the table, it's because he's lost control of his temper, and that kills Helmklever. And like, that's my favourite bit of summoning dark meddling, actually, just because it's such a small loss of control.
Yeah.
It's a tiny little loss of control and it kills somebody. And I know, like, it doesn't really, and Bashfulson's like really bringing Vimes back down to earth with that, like, you didn't kill him, fear killed him, whatever. But I mean, what he did lead to that. And obviously he would have been in the dark eventually and died. It would have happened, but, right?
Yeah, And the interludes as well, and the way they make the pursuit of the summoning dark in the interlude so ominous, because it's not obvious when Vimes first gets the summoning dark in him. It is looking back on it, but it's not obvious at the time. So it takes a second to clock that this rain-soaked city that the entity is moving through is, that's Vimes' mental landscape, is this rain-soaked city. Which is great, especially because, like, Hatful of Sky, we got to explore this idea of mental landscapes in a completely different way with these huge green open fields.
Yes. Oh, yeah. The idea of him, like, believing in the Who Watches the Watch so much as well that he's created this entity.
Yeah.
In his head. The
guarding dark.
Yeah. How many iterations of Watchmen do you... Is there a Watchman guarding the Watchman in the Watchman?
The Watchmen are definitely recursive.
Watchmen's all the way down.
Yeah. Vimes has got recursive. Oh, yeah. He's got a case of the recursive Watchmen. I've seen this before.
I think Nanny Ong makes a cream for it. It's fine.
Don't ask what else it does. Lovely on toast. But yeah, the it was slow, but it never stopped following. It would catch up. And finally, when the bars slam down on it and this ominous italicized figure comes into view, and of course it's smoking a cigar and it's wearing a helmet and it's got the shoulders hunched just so against the rain.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do like Vetinari and Dromnot after Vimes leaves that meeting. Vetinari asks Dromnot if he's a betting man, and Dromnot says he enjoys the odd flutter. I like that part of Dromnot's characterization, by the way, it's a very sidebar, is similar to Blouse in that he the inverted commas thing.
Yes.
The way that it's got the commas around flutter, and you can see the little same little wiggle that Blouse does with his...
Yes.
A little flutter.
A little flutter, sir.
Been brushing up on my sword drill.
Yes, wouldn't like to put a dollar on that.
Given a contest between an invisible and quasi-demonic thing of pure vengeance on one hand and the commander on the other, where would you wager a dollar? I wouldn't, sir. That one would go to the judges.
And in fact, it did.
It very much did.
He was stuck frozen in time, axe above his head. And as he put it very viscerally, with the grags in front of him cowering like maggots. He was just absolutely frozen there. And then luckily, Bashfulson and Angua.
Yeah.
Step in, because who knows? You're allowed to make your own choice on that one.
You are, but absolutely.
Him as this kind of supernatural being. It's brilliant, like when he's still in Ankh-Morpork and he's approaching those dwarves and he's where's the bloody thing? The dwarves took one clear look at the approaching vision, haloed in torchlight and mist, and took to their heels. Like, yeah. I love Sam Vimes as slightly corrupted entity because he's fighting it the whole time. So,
it's cool. Loxair in the Discord made an interesting point that this idea with young Sam, that, you know, if you do it for a good excuse, you do it for a bad one, with being late to read to him, like sort of tied in with the alcoholism side of it, that the just one drop is one drop too many. And I think there's definitely an element of that with the dark as well. It's that the cage has to slam down, the watchman has to watch it, be the guarding dark, and how do you put it? Keep the dark in. I'm not here to keep the darkness out, I'm here to keep it in, is what the guarding dark says to the summoning dark.
Yeah.
It's all very one drop too many.
It is, yeah. It's kind of an acknowledgement that he does have that darkness just inherent in him, even without the summoning dark trying to kind of draw it out of him. And he knows, and I think we've talked about it before, he knows that he's got this in him, and therefore he is in this constant fight with himself.
Yeah. And there's also, if you think back to where the summoning dark finds him and enters him, which is a horrible turn of phrase, it's right at the beginning. He's when he's pissed off at the Grags and he is down in the mine and he cuts his hand on the door.
Yeah, you've got to have the emotional opening.
Yeah, the emotional opening was there before he knew it, before his family had been threatened, before he knew what was happening.
The interview that I linked to in the first part, this trilogy of episodes, I think, in part one, I could say, Pratchett mentions that it was fun to write Vimes as a family man. So it's always, he said it's fun to age up characters and to write them in new ways. But, you know, a challenge what to still make it good for new readers. So it's not just like a, hey, you know, Vimes, here he is.
Here he is doing something thing.
And I like his turn of phrase. He said he doesn't save the world. What he does is give the world time to save itself.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
So Helm Clever.
Oh.
Look, I could sit here and talk about vines all day, but
I know. I'm sad we have to talk.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I am sad for Helm Clever. God, the whole interrogation scene is one of the most subtly cinematic bits of the book. The pieces on the board moving quickly while he quietly is almost whispering his answers and piecing things together for Vimes.
Yeah. The idea of him just being able to close off enough of his mind with the sad thing to start talking is quite cool. It's very believable.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way Vimes kind of half plays the game and takes the breaks in Helm Clever talking to put everything together in his own head, even though he's not familiar with the game.
Mm.
Yeah. He's able to use it as a secondary thing so that his mind can tick away and do it.
Yeah, absolutely. The bit about the troll, when he's talking about his club that got...
Well, yeah, he sort of finally emotionally breaks and he said, it was my club that Mr. Shine gave me.
No, I hate that. I hated that bit. It's so good.
And his whole confession that we could hear him hammering and I wished him dead so the noise would stop, and then it carried on in my head. And he says, I could have turned the wheel, but I was afraid of the dark guards who have no souls.
Hmm.
Which, yeah. These are the same guards that Vimes cuts down later in the book. And I feel like the have no souls is kind of a, make sure we're not inclined towards them.
Mm, yeah. I'd forgotten those, but that bit actually, where he did the soldiers at the end.
Yeah, same. But they are trying to kill him, so I've got a lot of time for what he's doing there.
Yeah. But you said the opposite when they were trying to kill him in his house.
No, I didn't have time for it. I said it was the first time we'd seen Vimes act without due process.
Well, now we saw him finish it without due process.
But he didn't kill the
He didn't kill the defenseless Grags, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Angra, for not making us find out.
And Bashfulson. Who you mentioned last week, because we slightly ran over the section we were talking about, his silent interactions with Vimes.
I may have cut that bit out of the main episode.
Well, we'll bring it back now. So, yeah, Bashfulson,
yeah. Interesting how Vimes defers to him with his little nods or shakes of the head during the interview. I think Vimes straight away recognises him as just far more knowledgeable, and obviously recognises and respects him as far more knowledgeable, which two different things. He doesn't go all petty with it.
He's also self-conscious enough about the fact that he's capable of losing control. Sorry.
It's all right. Just expel the malevolent forces.
He's also self-conscious enough about losing control that at one point he starts yelling at Helm Clever and he stops when he sees Bashfulson shaking his head. And that's what reminds him, okay, no, there's no point taking it out on this guy. Yeah, Bashfulson, towards the end of the book, after they found Vimes, when the summoning dark has left him, Vimes starts getting ready to have a go at everyone in the room, and Bashfulson stops with, no, you listen to me.
Mm.
You had this in you. I knew you were coming here because it wanted you to come here.
Yes. And people do listen to Bashfulson, doesn't he? He's clearly very charismatic.
Yeah.
I compared him to Mightily Oats last time. And while he doesn't have as good a name as Mightily Oats, but nobody does. It's not fair. It wasn't fair to make that comparison.
No,
he's definitely a lot more a natural, if not an evangelizer even, just a natural leader, I think.
Yeah, and in a completely different way to how, say, Moist is charismatic. There's no razzle-dazzle or show about him. He's just very calmly right.
Yes. Yeah.
So when he has the... he uses his internal axe against Ardent.
Yes. And he has his internal solitary nature, even though he's in a room with 19 other dwarves.
Brief Ridcully moment, who is having so much fun.
He's having the time of his fucking life. I love him.
What larks, eh? Very cloak and dagger.
Sorry! I mean, sorry.
Take a seat. Compost is fine.
Moment to acknowledge the fact that he calls Sam.
I feel like he's kind of earned it largely by being very reasonable a lot of the time.
Yep.
I mean, he's not. He is pig-headed, stubborn, and completely unreasonable. But at the same time, he's also really quite reasonable when it comes to city stuff.
Yeah. And it also made me think, obviously, they're peers.
They are.
They're not. it's not a like employee-employer thing. It's barely a professional relationship. It is occasionally, but he probably sees him mostly in like function dinners or like even just fucking dinner parties. Probably he gets invited over by Sybil.
Yeah. And he is not the type to call a duke your grace. And I feel like Vimes probably appreciates that enough. He'll accept whatever he does get called.
You know me? I'm on to call a duke a Sam.
And then Sybil, who I don't know if I've mentioned, but I do love.
No, I'd heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. Casually just copied the entire fucking painting with a pantograph.
Oh, fucking. Did you get the bit about her teacher?
A girl who knew how to use a set square and a protractor would go on a long way in life. Miss Turpitude.
Miss Turpitude. Moral, I expect, was her first name, because what a lovely name for a girl.
Absolutely. I have not used a pantograph. I've linked to a bit of an explanation for one. I'm not going to try and explain it, because while I vaguely do understand the concept, I do not understand it well enough to explain it.
Yeah, I know the technique of like you separate a reference picture into grids and then you can grid it out yourself. But I imagine it must be for much more complex ones than I've tried to do.
I've worked with scaling designs mostly for like patterns and stuff. Course, so yeah. I can scale them up and scale them down. Yeah. But I've not used a pantograph for that. I have used a set square and a compass for it.
But if you used a pantograph for a pair of pants, that would be great.
Well, now I need a pantograph. I was slightly confused when I googled it, because pantograph is also the name for, you know, like those cable things on top of trains.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's also a pantograph.
Oh
yeah.
So I guess it's in both cases it's pan as the prefix, isn't it? I know guys, please don't tell me that it's not pant. It's a joke.
And I love how
I said that. I'm probably wrong.
It might be panto.
Helico. Like, what is it? A helico.
Helicoped.
Helicoped. I'm not helicoping. Right.
She insists on coming along to Coombe Valley. She's dreamed of it all her life. And when she says, you can't gallivant off to see it without me, Vimes is responding, I don't gallivant. And then after Roach says no, and obviously the whole bit she says to him, I quote, and Vimes thinks to herself, that said, damn.
I do love the bit where she's like, I shall simply tell them we're not involved.
Yeah. I mean, she could, though.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sounds ridiculous coming from everyone else, but...
From Sybil, it works.
Absolutely, it does. But then she gets the fear.
She does get the fear. Oh, everything with young Sam, like, I mean, I love when they're reading to him in the... carts on the way to Coombe Valley, and detritus is doing the hippopotamus. He had his eyes like saucers, and yeah, the fear that sets in when he's not back. And it starts with this very calm, he'll be back, he's always back. Sometimes he's running back at the la, but he's always back. You'll see when they're bathing, and it gets to be any second now. And then she tells herself it's a wrong clock as she's walking to the nursery. Mm. And she's insisting to, you know, he will be here. He will walk through walls.
Yes.
And the bit that genuinely does make me cry is when she comes in and tells Sam she's going to read to him. And her heart did not sink. It couldn't. It was already as low as any heart could go. But it curled up and whimpered as she watched the little boy stare at her, at the door, at her again, and then throw back his head and scream. Like, proper makes me well up.
It does. But then if young Sam cries, soon relieved I cry. By Sam Vimes's...
The way it's described when he's reading Where's My Cow as he walks through, it fell to its knees, clenched its teeth, turned its face upwards like a man tortured beyond his wits and beseeching the gods of fortune and tempest, screamed, that is not my cow!
Pratchett has finally reached the peak of floral prose, followed by thud. And it is... Oh, yeah, thud. There we are.
And yeah, young Sam stops crying and just says, cow!
Yep, there you go. And that's a bit of mysticism, surely.
Yeah, but that's fine.
Yeah, but what I like is, you know, he doesn't make it home. He does read the thing, but the next, it's not using an excuse. The next night, they fucking stop everything they're doing.
He doesn't start just reading it really loudly from wherever he is.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, right, literally, I could not that time.
But I still read it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's a nice little, not because while the kind of not one mistake thing is a handy way to look at things, it's also a
one mistake is not an excuse to continue making mistakes.
Not an excuse. Yes, exactly. And the same, like the mistakes he's made as a policeman don't mean he's not going to try his best. I can hear the rain.
Yeah.
Sorry.
the relapses he has while he's drinking as well. You know, he gets sober and then he picks it up again in Men-at-Arms and then gets sober again.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. It's he is a man capable of
making mistakes
again.
He is very capable of getting up again.
That is one thing Sam Vimes does.
Anyway, let's move on to the girls. The girls. Tawny, we finally meet, who had a body that every other woman should hate her for, but she compounded the insult by actually being very likable. She had the self-esteem of a caterpillar, and as you found out in any amount of conversation with her, about the same amount of brain.
Unkind.
Unkind, but it is very sweet, especially when they do describe things like her blowing her nose, and that sounded angelic. I will say, this whole bit, the girls' night out bit, Terry Pratchett has written some of my all-time favourite female characters. He writes them very well, including like Angra and Cheery. I do feel like the girls' night out is not the best example of Terry Pratchett writing women, and I found it a bit cringy in a couple of places.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I would write a girls' night out, and I've been on a lot of them.
I mean, I haven't been on that many, to be fair, because but a few.
You have.
I don't count like you and I when we used to go out as like a girls' night out. I feel like that's in a different category.
Did we or did we not have feather boas?
Yeah, all right, no, fair point. I've been on plenty of girls' nights out. Things like Angra, you know, asking what's a screaming orgasm, and Sally doing it. Oh, we got to you just in time, girl. And
yeah, but the thing is, that does happen. Like, not admittedly with ours, but I've been on girls' nights out like this.
Oh yeah,
very similar.
I don't think it's bad or completely unrealistic. I just think it's not the strongest of his writing, especially the jerk syndrome bit. Like, I'm aware of that kind of thing. I've definitely never heard anyone use the term jerk syndrome.
No, I haven't. It was definitely used in like a you'll know this one, but no.
Yeah, I don't know if that's just wrong age or wrong genre of girl. I feel like someone said it to him.
Yeah, no idea.
Yeah. But I think part of what I struggle with a bit is that just as like a B plot, it all feels a bit, because there's so much action in the A plot, and Sally's got this whole other kind of C plot about the spying thing. It almost feels like one plot too many. As much as I like it, I think it's a very sweet little story. I like Nobby's relationship with Tawny and always being there if she needs a helmet to cry on.
Yeah.
It sometimes feels a bit crammed in, especially because the night out stuff is happening interspersed with like Helm Clever dying.
Yeah, and they're absolutely wasted when they get dragged back to the watch house.
What I feel like it would have made the book too long, but would have improved it, is that if we got like one scene of them all really hungover before they had to get on the coaches, and doing that thing where like Cheery's irritatingly cheery because she's dwarf and doesn't get hangovers.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like
I did like the scene where Sally's throwing up everything. And threw Angus up a comical umbrella.
Serves you right for drinking vine. Oh no, I've just thrown up a small cocktail umbrella is one of my favourite lines. But yes, I feel like Angua's part in it gets more fun once she has drinks in and starts like joking back with them rather than just being slightly sullen about the night out thing.
Yeah, definitely.
And I understand why she is, like, as a character.
Yeah, definitely. While we're on the girls, backwards names.
Oh, yep. Sally.
You've got yours, have you?
Anage. It doesn't really work.
Anage Nagar. Anage Nagar. And mine is Iniknar Flerak, which I think is great.
Iniknar Flerak is fantastic. Anage Nagar sounds like a vaguely racist thing. It would sounds like something that a genie would say in a vaguely racist panto.
Yes, or it looks like I should put a couple of apostrophes in there and make it a fantasy name.
Yeah, that too.
Just like sprinkle some apostrophes on.
But yes, vampires, they can't resist thinking no one will recognize their name if they spell it backwards.
I love that as just like a foible of the species.
I do like that when it's eventually revealed, you know, that she is a spy and what her motivation was. It is partly because she wanted to see proper policing and they're trying to improve things in Bonk.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it ties in nicely and underlines what Vetinari was saying, you know, about the everybody wants to be like this police force because you got Sam Vimes in charge of it. But then, like, right away, if you think back to, like, this is why Sally's joined, right away, her, like, one of her first things where the boss was seeing him wrapped in the ducky blanket, like, after no sleep, like, don't you fucking dare.
Oh, this is how
I am the most
properly.
Famous policeman.
Don't judge my duckies. I really... I need someone to draw that for me, please. Okay. Doesn't have to be you. Okay. If you've got a minute. Detritus.
Detritus. Oh, I love him so much.
I love him. I feel bad for him. He does this polite acceptance at being given the stables to sleep in. And does this, you know, thank you kindly. It's been clean. Being shackled.
Even though they're trying to provoke him into breaking out so they can kill him. He's much smarter than that. And I guess that's like an overt version of, I know it wasn't on purpose with Bunty, but it's like he's the diplomat. He's done diplomatic before. This is his first rodeo.
And, you know, back in Fifth Elephant, when they realize they've got those troll head trophies and they're panicking and think, oh, we should cover them up. And he walks in and he's like, oh, I know that guy.
Yeah. Oh, we used to have human heads all over. Don't worry about it.
He is very diplomatic. And I feel bad for him that he has to be.
That's it. Yeah.
But it is very impressive.
But yeah. And he's setting such a good example for Brick.
Oh, bless
he's
Brick.
He's such a good father figure. And Vimes is like, oh, they're happy but childless marriage. And so that bit gets underlined. And he's got himself a rescue troll.
I do wish we got a bit more of just Ruby ever, because we haven't really actually spoken to her. I say spoken to her. We haven't seen her like doing much in the book since Moving Pictures.
Yeah.
But she was such a great character in Moving Pictures, and her and Detritus' little romance. She has time. That's fine. I hope she's living her best wife and life and doesn't mind that Detritus has brought Brick home.
She's hanging out with Mrs. Colin.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
They run an illicit poker ring.
Oh my god, that's my favourite Discord again and ever. We got an email from a listener who pointed out like possible recurring theme thing, can't grow a witch on the chalk, and then Brick being this first Ankh-Morpork book troll. And
was that from Nikki's, wasn't it? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe can't grow a troll on Brick.
I did like that, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting way to look at it. And yeah, Detritus remembering, you know, his dad showed him Coon Valley and just hit him around the head and said, remember, and Detritus does the same thing. He just takes Brick to see, remember. All right. I just sort of generally remembered.
I know. And it's just like Brick is such a nice troll at heart as well. He's like, and just like, oh, you know, you don't need the details of his past fill in, because he's just like, you know, everything's always hurt and this hurts less than that. And you need to remember not to be horrible to dwarves. I've never wanted to be horrible to dwarves, really.
Oh, yeah,
that's fine.
Quite happy
no worries
to not be horrible to them.
I'll just have another bowl of food, please. Thank you. This is great. make hippo money, as Lance
make
called
hippo
for all
money. Oh, I love Brick. So Reginald Stitch did not need to be mentioned, but I had to shoehorn it in purely so I could say dynamically.
Yes, but dynamically.
The whole interaction of, we're very dynamic now. I was like, what do you mean? What, the paintings? Yes. Paintings are on the wall and people can look at them as much as they like.
Dynamically. He was thinking that it was very rude. You don't ask questions like that. Is it?
Yeah. And ask me what I'm doing. In a similar strain of person, we have the Wainsbury's.
Oh, the Wainsbury's, yes.
Oh, do you know the Coon Valley Wainsbury's?
I do know the Coon Valley Wainsbury's.
Do you
know
Bunty?
It's Bunty and her son. Now, it was a terrible misunderstanding, I hear.
Had to go to 4X in a hurry over a complete misunderstanding, but he's now into sheep in a big way.
In sheep in a big way. And, you know, there are new opportunities out there for a man that perhaps can't technically be seen on this continent anymore.
That bit does one of my favourite like comedy lines, which is where you get the third person monologue. So it's and Bundy, and at no point do you see her saying it in quotation marks until we get to "and I've cleaned out the stables for the troll," and it's so much funnier.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, it is. Again, it's like a little cinematic scene shift, isn't it? But in a very book only way.
It is. And I love this concept of the ladies who organize, you know, Sybil, Sybil's Quirm Ladies College contact network. But mostly, barring obviously the Baroness from the Fifth Element, they do seem to care and they know about each other's children and daughters, and young Sam is lovely. Yeah. Bunty's full name, Berenice Wainsbury, name Mouse Father.
Which must have come as a relief.
And her husband, who would quite happily just be left with his fishing flies.
Yeah. I like the little inversion of what Vimes was expecting. Mr. Wainsbury, the magistrate, wasn't quite the venal pocket liner Vimes had expected. the harsh little line of when he doesn't take his advice and goes, "As you wish, of course, I shall watch the river in any case."
Yeah. I mean, he does know best in that situation. Obviously, he doesn't know best in that Vimes doesn't wash up as a corpse, but...
How was he meant to know that Vimes was powered by a malevolent force the quarter of a millennium old?
That's not something that often comes up for the most magistrates, I imagine.
How many was it? A quarter of a million years old? Whatever he said it was.
A long time.
Super,
it was old.
Super, super duper old, as Ben Murray said, I'm sure.
That is exactly what Vesinari said.
Exactly.
He doesn't give an age. Or not in the quote I have, anyway. Lastly, before we move on, we get a brief Mr. Pony cameo.
Oh, yeah.
He's now head of the Artificers Guild.
Artificer, which one day I'll say the correct way the first time.
Artificer.
Artificer.
Not Artificer. So we get this whole thing. It's this one last loose ends being wrapped up conversation where Carrot is taking Vetinari down, and we have these incredible devices
down
that can
to the
power
mine, not
a
like
lot.
Taking him down.
Yeah. So it takes him down to
finally,
the mine.
Carrot takes Vetinari down, takes his rightful place on the throne.
Yeah, let's not do that.
None of us saw it coming.
What an ending. No, he takes him down to the mine. He shows him these devices that could power pretty much everything and these underground rails and it.
Just a little casual perpetual motion machine.
Yeah, yeah.
He Vetinari refuses to understand.
He doesn't need to. He's got
very
people
Vetinari,
for that.
Though, isn't he? He does similar with like De Quirm stuff, doesn't he? Like people are like, look at this. He's like, it's a device, is it? That'll get us somewhere. Super.
Yep, that'll
right.
work. Yep, lovely.
Marvellous. This is not my... He's very good at delegating.
He's very good at delegating. That's what he's got his clerks for.
And the fucking metal's shooting in front of his head. I was like, was that meant to happen, was it?
And this is coffee. This makes coffee. Right. And then locations. Obviously, Coombe Valley is the big one. And
Coombe Valley. Incredible. I mean,
the descriptions are amazing. This volatile, terrifying place of chaos. Mm. The Coombe River didn't just rise in this valley. It leapt and danced. By the time it was halfway down, it was a crisscross of thundering waters merging and parting. They carried and held great rocks, played with whole fallen trees from the dripping forest that colonised the scree built up against the walls. They gurgled into holes and rose again, miles away as fountains. It's great. It's such an incredible visual.
It is. It is amazing. And like the little details, like the cauldrons of water that elsewhere would have a name like the Devil's Cauldron. But, you know, there aren't enough devils here. It's just a cauldron. It's just a boiling cauldron of water. Like the other five boiling cauldrons of water. We walked past a minute ago. We're not stopping.
Yes. If we start naming them after devils, we'll get more devils. Yeah. They'll make more cauldrons.
Just fucking perpetual devil machine. Recursive devils, recursive watchmen. Now you got a party.
It's cauldrons all the way down.
I was trying to read about this to find out if there was an obvious round world parallel. I couldn't find one. If there is, like, specifically to this one, but please tell me about it, listeners. This is on a flying boulder. But it's called karst geography, K-A-R-S-T. So it's like dissolving limestone, basically, that create the sinkholes and the sinking streams and the caves and the springs and everything like that. There are lots of places all over the world like this. One of the coolest is Mammoth Cave in Kentucky in the US. which is the longest known cave system with 400 miles of passageway mapped so far.
Wow. I want to go there.
I know. It's a national park, so you can tour like 10 miles of it or so, I think.
Nice.
And then the other thing it reminded me of, although I don't know if this is a limestone one, actually, is the Bolton Strid. Do you know what I'm on about?
No.
That you definitely do. It's the street, the river that looks like a stream, but is actually like fucking half a mile deep.
Oh, yeah.
And kills everybody who walks into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll link to Atlas Obscura's thing on that in the show notes, because it's one of the coolest and most horrifying pieces of geography we have in this country.
Yeah.
And the Forest of Dean is apparently some cool limestone bits as well.
Yeah. I mean, I love like going into cave systems. There's something really wondrous to being about in these like huge underground caves and realizing that water created all of this during ice ages, like millions and millions of years ago.
We even see some, like, Pratchett's obviously very into it as well. We see something like this in The Last Continent even, don't we?
Yeah, yeah, the sort of cave that's been underground for a millennia and also 10 minutes.
And in fact, Null Arbor in Australia, I think, might be limestone, but definitely is one of these cool, like, geological rock what's-its.
Geological rock what's-its.
Yeah, it means no trees. Geological rock what's-its. Yeah, that sounds right.
The lesser known original draft of the B-52 song. Da, 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 da.
As much as soul music is not my favourite book, I feel like I could be a lyricist in one of the bands. Hi, we're Miscellaneous Geography. Geology, fuck. Oh, there's definitely a band name somewhere in this geological area, though. All right, we'll come back to that.
We will.
We won't.
Little bits we liked.
Little bits.
What do
we
you
liked.
Like?
I like the way that the watch at Pseudopolis House react to Sybil coming back to her ancestral home.
I forget, it's Pseudopolis Yard, I think, gets dubbed.
Pseudopolis Yard, yeah, that's right, yeah.
But I forget that it was Sybil's and she gave it to the watch.
Yes, because at the moment in Night Watch, don't you, where he
goes to
his old watch house and yeah, teenage Sybil answers the door, ready for murder. but yeah, I like, the way that the watcher described, like, tiptoeing around her. They spoke differently too, slowly and hesitantly, anxiously scanning the sentence ahead for expletives to delete, which very much reminds me of when you go on site or something and the chaps there are trying to be, because now we're in mixed company, and you know, you can explain all your fucking likes, that it's fine, I do swear quite a lot in the office and such, but they're like, no,
mixed company, behave yourselves.
We're gonna be on our best behavior.
And Sam gets guarded by trolls who volunteered to come in and keep an eye on the kid, but as well as the watchman obviously adjusting their behavior, Sybil just settles into it as if she's never left and cleans out the tea urn.
Terrible thing to do.
Horrible thing to do.
You have some lists for us.
Just a couple, but it's something Pratchett always does really, really well and makes me giggle. There's a list of street names. We've got Etcap Street, which jumps on from your obscure reference video last week. Etcap Street, Money Trap Lane, Crybaby Alley, Scuttlebutt Court, the GBs, Pellicle Steps.
The GBs.
And then when they go up into the attic at Pseudopolis to look for the copy of the painting, because the Bramkins never threw anything away, it says men's boots, comma, various, risible puppets, comma, string and glove, model theatre and scenery.
One day I'll have an attic big enough to write deranged labels on things like that.
We don't use the word risible enough.
No.
Risible. Very risible. Of course, Sam's imagined apple cores, comma, various, leftovers, comma, need eating up.
Which then leads to a footnote. It's practically just going off on tangents here.
Yeah, I'm so guilty of the need eating up thing. Bewildered that he's doing the food some sort of favour.
Yes.
What shouldn't one be able to do, Francie?
That, Joanna.
That.
Is when Carrot is examining the coach and then showing it to Vimes after Ridcully has done something.
hasn't done something.
Yes, sorry. Sorry. he lifted the laden coach above his head. "You shouldn't be able to do that," said Vimes. "That's right, sir," said Carrot.
I'd like to think there's a hint of questioning there with Vimes as well, because, like, Carrot probably could do that.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, we'll change the intonation slightly. He lifted the laden coach over his head. "You shouldn't be able to do that," said Vimes. "That's right, sir."
Just, is this magic or is this just Carrot? Is he shirtless and gleaming in this scene by any chance?
If he is, it's not mentioned, so I assume he can't be.
Pratchett's gotten over his horniness for a bit then.
The horse!
Sorry. You've missed one of yours, Francie.
Have I? Oh, that's right.
Ogglesoggle,
exactly so. We've skipped forward a little here. We're in the caves underneath the Coombe Valley, and it is getting close to 6 o'clock, and we know that because the poor little imp is going, ogglesoggle. And if I can be bothered, I'm going to put the sound effect over that, because you know exactly what it sounds like. It sounds like drowned audio. And that's a very good way of putting it into words. I also like the kind of, not quite, but Jingo-esque callback of having the imp breaking into a moment with a, like, of mortal peril with a reminder of home, even though it's slightly different because it's more rooted in reality, whatever. I just like that kind of, the technology going, oi, stop happening at home now. Pay attention.
Oh, God, the Jingo one does. That's such a gut punch. Oh, such a great bit of writing.
Yeah. But anyway, we're talking about that now.
The horse, when the coaches start really going, there was a fifth horse larger than the other four and transparent, visible only because of the dust and the occasional glint of light off an invisible flank. It was what you got if you took away a horse but left the movement of a horse, the speed of a horse, the spirit of a horse, the part of a horse which came alive in the rushing of the wind, the part of a horse that was in fact horse. Which is a nice callback to Tiffany Aching.
It is, although it does make me imagine this horse as the weird shaped chalk thing.
I do, same. And also in that bit when they're going at the top speed, you get this light shift where the landscape ahead is bluish and behind them it's sort of red.
Yeah, and, couple callbacks there.
Yes.
And all the way back to Johnny.
All the way back to Johnny.
And then a thief of time.
And I was talking about how the visible spectrum worked as well on a rabbit hole the other day, so that was an extra bit of delight for me. Hi. Wavelengths and such,
yes, bioluminescence, yes.
Speaking of callbacks, though, there's a few dynamically. The horse is a dynamic horse.
Oh, galloping.
God, we've got to stop.
Very sorry, Joanna. Please tell us about this next.
What I love is when you do this posh voice, if you do it for too long, it starts going into comedy French.
Oui, oui. And now, Joanna, we must go to Les Elephants 5.
Speaking of callbacks, there's a few bits that kind of go specifically towards the fifth elephant. Ella on our Discord pointed out that the glass breaking cue also gets used in Fifth Elephant. Very similar kind of, oh shit, something's wrong moment. There's a lovely moment when they're setting off and Vines and Sybil discuss their last holiday. Well, it was very interesting all the same. Yes, dear, werewolves tried to eat me. And obviously you have things like Rhys turning, the low king turning up, and he's kind of on the throne thanks to Vines.
Yeah, and then you do get reminded he's not nice.
Yes, I love the reminder that he can be quite nasty, or not nasty, cutthroat.
Yes. He's a politician in a very dangerous pool.
Yes. And the parallels we talked about in the beginning section as well between Arden in this and Dee was the name of the dwarf remember in the Fifth Elephant. Coming at it from very different angles and for very different reasons, but the behaviour is similar.
Yes. Yeah.
And Sally's, you know, the resolution of her storyline, her motivation being that she's part of this new police force in Bonk and wants to do good, that starts in the Fifth Elephant. That starts with Tantony, the watchman that Vimes kind of ends up inadvertently taking under his wing.
Oh, yeah. Also, a couple of bits in the caves reminded me of the Fifth Elephant, just when he's waking up in the absolute pitch darkness.
Mm.
Yeah. Very that.
There's another bit, but I'll wait till I go on my long, long rant about how much I love this book. Before okay. that, Francine, do you want to talk about water?
Yeah, just briefly, because I figured we probably had quite a long one as the conclusion. I really enjoyed the water imagery throughout this and the kind the few little threads or tributaries, if you will. Sorry, tributaries.
Tributaries.
Very sorry. Yeah, just kind of going through this in a similar way to The Dark, but I'd say parallel. So obviously you've got the rainy city in like Warpork, and then you've got the rainy internal city. You've got the mirror there, which I liked very much. And that mm-hmm. just sets the scene in the way that Pratchett does with the weather. Just
yeah.
This helps add to the atmosphere. And then you have this constant reminder of the strength of water and water being melded with time or with social movement and everything like that, that I really enjoyed. So you have either the strength of water as a slow drip, drip, dripping away and changing the shape of mountains, or you have it as a flash flood filled with boulders, kind of sweeping away entire battlefields. And I've just got fucking paragraphs of quotes here that I'm not going to read out because that's just far too much at the end. But the water dripping on a stone, dissolving and removing, changing the shape of the world one drop at a time, flowing underground, bubbling up in unexpected places. And this is Mr. Shine talking to Byron, so this is like a Coombe Valley call forward, I guess. And so he obviously wants to compare the two, and so you got kind of got the geography having its psychic impact on the world as well here, I think. Coombe Valley being the physical manifestation of these social problems. And then later on you've got Vimes thinking back to Mr. Shine's words while Helm Clever is having a little breakdown and saying, water dripping on a stone, and it depends where the drops fall, doesn't it, Mr. Shine? What good has it done this poor devil? And,
yeah,
you know, that's the point, that the water is impersonal. The change, although it's, you know, quite a nice little thing doing it through this speakeasy board game thing, it's at the end of the day still gonna drown a bunch of people who didn't.
Yeah.
It's a force.
It's not a malevolent entity. It is a neutral, it's nature.
That's it, yes. Thank you.
It is chaotic and uncontrollable.
Yes, exactly so. And then when we get into the caves themselves and we get this kind of calcification of the water and this solidification of it, and instead of destroying or shaping, now we have like the water preserving something. And obviously, in its most obvious form, it is preserving the dwarves and the trolls and the king and the whatever. And it just makes way for some beautiful imagery. So the axe struck the white, wet, stony waterfall and smashed through the drip of millennia. Time fell in shards around it.
God.
I know. And then too many people in a living cave killed it in some way, the dwarf said. And so the kings would be left in the dark to finish their game. In with luck, peace, water dripping on a stone, changing the shape of the world one drop at a time, washing away a valley. And then you just kind of get these combined slow and fast metaphors kind of put together there, which I really enjoyed. And then just a couple little bits kind of infiltrating the whole thing. So you got like the mud covering the corpses of the dwarves.
And slowly rising.
Yeah, exactly. And going back just briefly to the flood washing the dwarves and the trolls into the caves, one of my favourite lines from the whole book.
Yeah.
So this is the Diamond King of Trolls speaking from the cube. He's saying, so troll fought troll, and dwarf fought dwarf, and fools made fools of us all as we fought to stop a war until the disgusted sky washed us away.
That was nearly my quote. The disgusted sky washed us away is a fantastic line.
Amazing. And then, of course, Vimes being not self-aware, but like being almost force-wally with his like, oh, this seems a bit too fucking neat, doesn't it? With Coombe Valley was forcing cooperation on them. Damn Coombe Valley. I saw that was a bit too pat, but nature can be like that. Sometimes you got sunset so pink there, no style at all. Which we've seen before recently, haven't we?
Yes.
A garish sunset. I just became aware of the water in this one, more so than The Dark, interestingly.
And just one last minor tie-in. Ooh. Fred could feel it in his waters right at the beginning.
He could feel it in his fucking waters.
And now here we are.
And now look where you've gotten us, Fred.
You in your waters.
Honestly. Oh, dear. So do you want to give us do you have some overarching thesis for us? A little slice of thesis?
Healthy
a little
thesis.
Rainbow of thesis.
Something that runs through this is this a river. No, it's idea of using knowledge and what happens if you don't know everything that's happening, or if you willfully refuse to understand everything that's happening. Mm. And it goes out into a bigger meta of how you engage with the book as a reader. So you have right from, you know, the beginning of the section, but really from the beginning of the book, the way the Grags are interacting with this concept of truth. Helm Clever says that the Grags feared what come for them in the darkness, because they agree with Ardent's story. Despite knowing what happens, they say, yes, it's true. It must have been a troll. It is true, because truth is what a Grag says.
Yes.
Which is a really, really contrasts with, again, going back to the fifth elephant quickly, the ransom aria from Bloodaxe and Ironhammer that Sybil performs to basically say, yes, their bloody well is a precedent.
Yes.
Part of it is the value of truth is greater than gold, for a given value of gold.
But truth, of course, in Dwarfish, that we have a precedent for this, because the scone was the true scone, even though it wasn't.
Yes, it was the grandfather's axe.
And yeah.
As the precedence of the song sets, Ciri, you know, said, explains to Vimes, to refuse that would be not being a dwarf.
Yes.
And these Grags who embody dwarfishness also very much embody a very specific flavour of truth that is not truth.
Mm. I like how their characters shift in vulnerability as it goes on. So when they're describing them being scared and running to Coombe Valley, you start to realise, like, these are very vulnerable old dwarves. And
yeah, and especially once they're without Ham Crusher, who it seems was very much a firebrand, a ringleader.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first one willing to direct... to reject truth, you know, one of the Grags killed him because he was trying to destroy the cube, which it's destruction of words. It's criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, you have that set up in the last section with Kara explaining the cube as, you know, it's a recorded history. It's effectively a written history,
mm-hmm.
which makes the destruction, you know, akin to Vimes being a blackboard monitor.
Yeah.
And along with that vulnerability that the Grags have is the fear that they have. Again, Helm Clever explains it. They don't understand the city. They don't understand why trolls are allowed. They don't understand the people who don't. They fear everything now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's that fear and misunderstanding leading to hatred.
Yeah. And they set themselves up for it.
Yeah. It's a willful rejection of knowledge.
Mm.
We refuse to accept that the world is anything more than a dream. And as a result, we are afraid. And as a result, we turn to hate.
It's very modern conspiracy theorist, isn't it?
Yes. Fucking fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, Star Wars stuff. Sorry, I had to get that in there before someone said, hey, you're doing the Star Wars thing. And so then you have Vimes' version of that, which we talked about, his willful rejection of Mystic. He could try and take the time to understand the Summoning Dark. I don't think that would have helped him.
No.
But he absolutely refuses to. He refuses to accept it. And as such, he doesn't have an understanding of the fact that there is a malevolent entity in him.
Do you think part of it is he's so used to fighting down the darkness anyway? It took him quite a long time. It took until the entity was actually whispering, let go, before he was willing to
acknowledge in any way there might be something.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And also he's so used to Mystic being a very specific shape and a kind of, right, this is what we're dealing with, this is what we're dealing with. That's going above my pay grade, and it's going to the wizards.
Yeah. To the wizards.
And then you have these mysteries that run through the book. Like, while the Summoning Dark being in Vimes is clear, it's very slowly revealed, and it's not spelled out thoroughly until the end.
Mm.
And then the reader gets to look back to things like where he first cut his hand on the door.
Mm-hmm.
And realize how long the dark has been influencing him and how much those vignettes have been a part of what's been going on in his mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Because some might argue it's super obvious on first reading. It actually wasn't for me. The first time I read this book, I was kind of confused because I thought the dark was physically chasing Vimes through the Ankh-Morpork.
I don't remember the first time I read this book.
I remember having that confusion.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's you can. Yeah, you could argue it either way. Probably some people are better at fucking getting hints in books than other people. I'm not one of them, by the way. I'm not. but I find that makes things more enjoyable. And you can look back and everything
in italics.
Some of it, yeah, some of the inner monologue was in italics, and when he's running up the stairs, the "I'll kill you, I'll kill you." But you know, that could just be emphasis. But then, yeah, when you get to read it, knowing what happens at the end, it's very fun.
Yeah, and the way things like the scene where he's running up the stairs, something else is making the body work a bit.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And again, you can read that as you're just driven by this fear and anger, you know, in the same way that, you know, people say the mother can lift a car off a baby with the adrenaline.
Yeah, you're it's very much
driven
that.
By something, yeah. This case, actually, malevolent force.
Yeah.
Swim for miles.
But it's hard to tell sometimes. You know. So you have this mystery. You have this mystery, this question of the summoning dark running through the book. You have the ongoing Sally question in her whole B plot. Mm. Because although, yes, she is a spy and it's signposted and it's revealed. And there's always the sort of something's not right. She does also seem very genuine. You know, if she was just there to do a job, she wouldn't be taking Tawny out on the piss and explaining jerk syndrome to her. And she's genuinely quite well-meaning. She's. As much as Angua struggles with her, she's not objectively like mean to Angua, and she sort of tries to relate to her.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's a spy from an allied force, as it turns out.
Yeah.
Which is, not ideal for someone like Angua, who's very upfront. Well, like values people being very upfront.
Yes. Angua is very direct. And to go into this meta bit, I think the scene with Death really says it really well. Death is... walking with Vimes, because Vimes is walking with Death, but, you know, don't worry, I've got a book.
Yes.
and it appears the butler did it, which I've mentioned on this podcast before, Trial by Content, a podcast I like. They have pop culture debates. Mm. A few weeks ago, they had a really good, like, best murder mystery of the 21st century episode, but they did, they always do a little history section near the beginning, and one of the things they talked about is the origins of the butler did it.
Okay.
I can't remember all the details, but I highly recommend it. I'll link down below.
Cool, that sounds good.
But yes, he says the butler did it. And then he says, it's a made-up story. All one needs to do is turn to the last page and the answer is there. What, therefore, is the point of deliberately not knowing?
The journey,
Death. The journey! The journey! But so we have, in the book, we have this deliberate not knowing.
Yeah.
We have Vimes rejecting the mysticism. We have the dwarves rejecting the idea of the Grags rejecting anything but the truth that makes the most sense for them, rejecting the idea of the real world. Brick on drugs until he's not. His version of rejecting the real world. Even Vimes, like, he's aware something's up with Sally, but just not prioritizing it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then as readers, we experience this bigger reveal at the end, because we're so focused on what's happening to Vimes, the summoning dark that's in him, getting to the valley. Vimes is not focused on the contents of the cube. Mm. He's maybe curious. I think Bashful's certainly curious.
Yeah.
But it's not his priority. His priority is bringing the Grags to justice for ordering the attack on his family and, you know, for everything else they've been fucking doing. Yeah. And the death of the miners.
Yeah.
The cube is incidental and then becomes the biggest part of it, as well as the Tak and Dwarf propaganda. What the Dwarves were looking for, it was such a mystery that it was almost forgettable. And then you get the reveal of it, the fact that they came to sign a treaty.
Yeah.
That your Troll King's line, which is so great, the disgusted sky washing us away.
Mm.
The discovery of the cave along with it, which they've, you know, was part of the secret. It was there with the cube, and that they've come to destroy because they don't want that to be the truth.
Yeah.
And it gets almost too neatly summed up with, you have this things that Tak wrote right at the beginning of the story.
Mm.
With the paragraph at the end that there's a footnote, it has clearly been added in another hand.
Yeah.
And then you get the blasphemous version of the things that Tak wrote, which is that Tak saw the geode coming to life and smiled and says all things strove. And Tak delighted in the life that came unbidden. And that was the first troll.
And it's such an underlining of what a hateful belief system you must have to find that horrifying.
Yeah.
To imagine absolutely. That your god is a love, or not a god, your being is a loving force. was so horrifying to you. I talking like the secret and Vimes's motivations and that, I did make a note of while they were on their way, and Vimes is trying to think of, like, he's not making a plan, but he's underlining his aim, and he's underlining what it isn't. And I liked that, because it would almost be automatic to fall into the assumption that Sam Vimes wanted to find out the secret and save the world.
Yes.
But it's like, no, I'm going to arrest the dwarves that did the murder.
Yeah.
It's like, and there was that damn secret, but it occurred to him that even if he did find it and it was proof that the dwarves ambushed the trolls ambushed the dwarves, or they both ambushed each other, we may as well drop it down a hole himself. Like,
yes. And as it turned out, the truth was a useful political truth. And it turns out, you know, I like the detail that the Low King has been working with Mr. Shine, that they were trying to get Vimes there so the world could find out about this from an honest source.
Yeah.
And that he went faster than they were expecting. They had to fly Mr. Shine in overnight. It was a really great detail.
Yeah. Oh, and put a little, we learn about Little Strong in the Arm. The nimble dwarf who died.
The OG Strong in the Arm.
He did it. He saved his little cube. He
saved his cube.
And then Nobby saved the cube as well.
Definitely saved the cube, did Nobby Nobs. That's what he was doing.
Actually, so, yeah. That was a nice little, sorry.
Absolutely.
Frivolous callback to the fact that you accepted that Nobby Nobs stole this, that, or the other when he was thinking about AU Pessimal just not getting it.
Yeah.
And that little bit of knowledge, in this case, actually, it probably was good that Nobby picked it up, even if it wasn't with the purest of intentions. Like, it was like, all right, yeah. Nobby, come on.
I love Nobby because, again, he's not a malevolent force.
No, he's just chaotic neutral.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, I think it's really wonderful that this book takes this idea of rejecting knowledge and not knowing everything, and then uses it in about 8 different directions, including a certain amount of fooling the reader and even distracting the reader with what the real ending is, this bigger ending of this hopefully upcoming peace between trolls and dwarfs.
Yeah.
And then lands on, it would be a lot simpler if it was a story.
Mm.
But it isn't. Yeah. So it tells you it's not a story. There's lots of stuff that's got to happen. It's all very complicated. It's all very political. Oh, but that long-running metaphor about water dripping on a stone. Yeah. Also, that's really, really fucking paid off, though. We did pay that off. Look at these stalagmites.
and you can repair stalagmites and all that stuff. Yeah.
It's not a story. It just happens to be perfectly story-shaped because Terry Pratchett wrote it and he's a fucking good writer.
Yeah. But just to remind you that this could all still go very wrong.
Just in case. Francine, have you got an obscure reference finial for me?
I do. So Vimes is holding his little travel guidebook, which is written by one Eric Wheelbrace, which has a very obvious round world counterpart in Albert Wainwright. Now, Wayne is a nice name, little counterpart for a start, because Wainwright was a person who made a carts or wagons with the wheel brace, you know.
Yeah.
but he was a guidebook author himself, and Pratchett describes the Eric Brace's books, Eric Brace, as a man who apparently had walked on just about everything bigger than a sheep track in the near Ramtops, and even then had been belabouring mountain goats on apparently sheer cliff faces, and while pebbles slid and bounced around him, was clearly accusing them of obstructing his right to roam. Eric believed very firmly that the land belonged to the people, and also that he was more the people than anyone else was. and Pratchett's very clearly describing not only here Albert Wainwright, but a specific brand of the right to roam people, who, by the way, I very strongly empathise with and agree with on almost everything, but with the whole the map encased in waterproof material on a string around his neck, such people are not to be trifled with. He's absolutely right. Yeah. Never fuck with those people.
Yeah, no, do not.
I'm the person sitting there with the OS map up on my phone going, oh, fuck, that's right. You don't get any signal around here, do you? Fuck with me all you want. I'm not going to be able to do anything. but Wainwright's very cool. Among many other books, he published The Pictorial Guide to the Lakeland Fells, which is actually 7 volumes.
Wow.
Which he wrote in 13 years between 55 and 66. That's not 13 years.
They no, it's
published.
Not. It's
they were published
years.
Between those years. But he wrote them at an average rate of a page an evening, and they're handwritten and hand-drawn maps and everything.
Wow.
And they're absolutely beautiful. I don't have any copies, actually, but I've had some digital ones. I should get my hand on some copies. But he's got lovely handwriting. But they're still seen as the definitive guide to that neck of the woods with their maps and all. And everybody loves them. And it did fantastic things for the Lake District's tourism. And the Wainwright Prize is a literary prize for travel writing. And he's a very interesting fellow. It's quite droll, quite a lot of it. And certainly in the almost proto Bill Bryson-y kind of tones in some places, although it's a lot more of a proper guidebook than Bryson's ever are. This is quite near the beginning of one of the books. Walkers of a contrary turn of mind will summarily reject the advice to leave Armbath Fell alone and may indeed be strengthened in their determination to climb it. Nor are they likely to be deterred by the many trespassers will be prosecuted notices that Manchester Corporation have sprinkled about the landscape. They would be further outraged if, having paid their 12th for this book, they found it did not cater for their idiosyncrasies by offering some details of routes of ascent. Here, then, are four routes, all starting from the road along the west shore of Selmere. That's just stuff like that. Like,
I love that.
It's fucking beautiful. And he never wanted to, like, he was never that interested in having them published to start with. He wanted to have them published privately when he did finally agree to it, because he couldn't bear to go through finding a publisher. But like, eventually, it just, the quality of them got away from him, and he became a success almost against his will, which is quite funny.
Incredible.
Yeah. I like Wainwright. The whole Right to Roam topic, actually, is very interesting. I'd love to cover that one day. Today is not that day. It's 9:30. And I need to eat.
It's 9:30 and you're unmedicated. Right, I think that's everything we can say about the book Thud. Well, it's not, technically. So next month,
not it won't be.
It's not, and it won't be. Next month, we're doing a fun little month of bonus content, because there's just so much supplemental stuff to talk about right now.
Ancillary
events.
Ancillary.
I am not promising when any of these episodes are coming out, because we are still figuring out some scheduling. But you can expect episodes on things like Where's My Cow, the book companion to this. The Clacks and Thud board games, and they might have some rather special guests on them. We're probably going to have a look at The Actual Stroke of the Pen. We'll be talking about Tiffany Aching's Guide to Being a Witch, which comes out on the 9th of November. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, Rhianna Pratchett and Gabriel Kent are doing an event at the British Public Library on the 27th. I believe that's also going to be live streamed, so you can buy tickets. We'll link down below. And there's something else coming, which I'm not even going to tell you about. It's going to be an absolute surprise. I'm going to do one little clue, which involves two out of the four apostles. And if you can work it out from that, I'll be bloody impressed.
I wouldn't have. If I didn't have to, like, be vaguely involved.
So on that note, dear listener, until we return next month with our random pile of stuff that we talk about.
Dynamically
return next month. You can join our Discord, link down below. Follow us on Instagram at The True Show, Make Keep Fret. On Twitter at Make Keep Fret Pod. On Blue Sky, Make Keep Fret Pod. On Facebook at The True Show, Make Keep Fret. Join our subreddit, r/TTSMYF. Email us your thoughts, queries, castle snacks, and boulders, thetrueshowmakeyfretpod@gmail.com. If you want to support this financially, you can go to patreon.com/thetrueshowmakeyfret and exchange your hard-earned pennies for all sorts of bonus nonsense. Don't forget
nonsense.
So nonsensical, I can't even fucking say it. Don't forget to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, because it helps other people find us because of the cursed algorithms.
Oh, the cursed.
The cursed algorithms. And until next month, dear listener, it was close enough for now. I just cut the last line a bit short so I didn't have to do a hippopotamus impression.